Mandukya Upanishad, when the Advaita Prakarana, verse 33.
We're doing the chant.
Om Bhadram Karane Vishwinayama Devaha Bhadram Pashye Makshabhirya Jatraha Stirai Rangai Istushtuvagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahitanyadayuhu Swastina Indro Vriddhashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swasti nastarksho arishtanemihi Swasti no brahaspatir tathatu Om shanti 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 hi. Akalpakamajanyanam Apakalpakamajanyanam Nyaya bhinnam pachakshate Nyaya bhinnam pachakshate Brahmagnyayamajam nityam Brahmagnyayamajam nityam Ajainajam vibhudhyate Ajainajam vibhudhyate Akalpakam ajam jnanam Nyaya abhinnam prachakshate brahmagnyayam ajam nityam ajena ajam vibhujyate. When we're talking about, from the previous verse, this Atma Satyam, the Satya, that which is the reality, being itself, that doesn't come into being or going out of being, so the Satyam, that Atma, the self, is that Satyam. If we look at orders of reality, Atma is Satyam. Everything else is Mithya. It means Atma, the self, is not subject to past, present, or future. That is the definition of satyam, or the definition of that which actually is, the definition of reality. So here, the Atma is satyam. Everything else is mithya. So by this, the anubodha means by this, by means of this knowledge which has taken place after the teaching, in other words, the teaching of the shastra by the acharya, by the teacher, this is the knowledge that takes place, that yourself, this conscious being that you are, is in fact the reality. Everything else is mithya. And when that knowledge takes place, na sankalpayate, when that knowledge, by means of that knowledge, we would say, just to make this into a better sentence. By means of that knowledge, which is the recognition of myself as satyam and everything else as mithya, by means of that recognition, for the seeker, the mumukshu, for that person, no longer, means when that knowledge has, when there's clarity of that knowledge, anubodha. When you say the word anubodha, by the knowledge that takes place after what? After shravana, manana, nididhyasana of the shastra by the acharya. And so we're talking here by this word anubodha, jnana nishta. Nishtya jnanam means knowledge that is doubt-free. Knowledge that where the mind has owned up, for a mind that has owned up this knowledge. So having gone through the process of gaining this knowledge, having gained the antakarana shuddhi, which is also part of the gaining knowledge is gaining the mental maturity for this knowledge, and then gaining the knowledge through Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. At that time, when that takes place, then that seeker no longer has any sankalpas. By sankalpa here, what is meant is I'm no longer subject to my raga dvesha in the real sense of the term. I want this so that I can be happy. That sankalpa is not there. Or I don't want this so I can be happy. Those sankalpas aren't there. If they are, they're only mithya. They don't have any power. They're kind of what we call dagda bijas. They're kind of like burnt seeds. They don't have the power to sprout into the into the krodha, into the anger, into the frustration, or the rage, or when our disappointment or hurt or depression, when our raga dveshas are not fulfilled. That's not there. It's more like riding on water. You want something, you don't get it, it's fine. Because for the mature mind, the person who has this knowledge, the source of every object that you experience is the Atma. The source of the Atma, let me put it this way, the Ananda, or the fullness that you used to be seeking in the world, has been recognized to be the very source of every object that you experience, and free of every object that you experience. That's why when we use the word satyam, it's an order of reality, and if we use it within the Vedanta, it's an order of reality that has to go along with mithya and tucham. These are our orders of reality. The only thing that is satyam is the Atma, is the self. Everything else is mithya. It means everything else has no independent being whatsoever. And so everything that I experience in the world, whether I'm experiencing it just in the vrittis in my mind, or the sense perceptions that I have, or the emotions that I have, whatever experience is coming in my way, is arising in me, is arising in a stable conscious being that is changeless. And that changelessness of my being, the very swarupa, the very nature of my being, is what we call aparoksha. Aparoksha means it's self-evident. It's self-shining. It's not away from me. I do not need a pramana in order to experience it. In terms of mithya, I need a pramana. I need a means of knowledge to experience it. To experience this painting, I need my eyes. I need a pramana. To experience music, I need my ears. To experience any type of thought process, or inference, or presumption, or any of these means of knowledge that we have, or the knowledge that's gained through these means of knowledge, those means of knowledge are necessary. Without them, the perception is not there. This is not true for the self. The self is not in need of any type of means of knowledge. It's aparoksha. It couldn't be more near to you. It is your very being, and it is self-evident consciousness itself. So consciousness doesn't need a means of knowledge to come in and illumine it. Consciousness is the luminary of all means of knowledge. Right? It's just like the drishtanta, the illustration we use for it, is just like the sun doesn't need another sun to come in and light it up. Or you need a flashlight or any type of other luminary to light it up. Nothing's necessary to light up your being. Your being is self-evident. So when we're talking about gaining self-knowledge, it has nothing to do with lighting up the self, because you already are you. You already know yourself in terms of your self-experience. The problem is not that. The problem is ajnanam, is ignorance, which has caused self-ignorance, which has caused the mind to misidentify this aparoksha self, the self-evident self, with the experiences of the mind. That makes a mutual superimposition. That is the problem. That's why when you get self-knowledge, in a sense, nothing new has happened. In terms of your self-experience, it's just that you recognize that this me, your self-experience, the you that you've always been, you realize that this self is infinite, is Brahman. But it's you that you recognize as infinite. It's not the experience of something else, a big capital S self, somewhere else that you need a pramana to go reach it to have the experience of. That's not it at all. It's this conscious being, me, that is me, I recognize is stable and free from time. And in fact, the very swarupa, the very nature, the very self of every experience I have, equally. I have this vritti, this thought, has the satchit, Atma, myself, as it's being. Next thought, Satchitatma, as it's being. This emotion, Satchitatma, as it's being. The me, this me, never wavers in any way, and there is no experience that's separate from it. But the experiences that are not separate from it also don't bring about any change upon it, and that's why they are called mithya. They come into being and they go out of being, but the being that they enjoy is satyam, is me. They come into being, go out of being, the being is me. But since they can come into being and going out of being, they don't have any being of their own. If they had being of their own and they went their own way, they would be carrying the satchit with them, like another little person moving away. That's not what it is. They come into being and go out of being, being remains. And the being that remains is me. The ahankara, the I notion that a person has, is 50% correct in that the ahankara, the I notion, does label me as the I, but then it lassoes my experiences, ties those experiences to me. Like say if I say, you know, I am sad, right? The I am part is Brahman. The sadness belongs to the mind. It's an emotion in the mind. You know? Or I am tall, or I am thin, or I'm a man, or I'm a woman. I'm lassoing the I am to the body then, or to a quality in the body, or to a quality in the mind. But the I am part is correct. It's landing on you. So the difference between a samsari or an ajnani and a jnani is for the jnani, the I am lands on the same exact me that the I am of the ajnani lands on. Exactly the same. But the ajnanam is gone. And so same experience, but in one I have differentiated me and I'm no longer superimposing it onto my mind and body and sense organs. Whereas the ajnani is still superimposing that same me onto the mind, body, and the sense organs, and then takes itself to be limited and subject to change and all of this. I recognize myself as changeless, and not objectifiable. And in fact, this must be. I must be the same in all beings because I'm not an object in the creation. I'm not objectifiable. There's nothing to limit me. And everything in the creation simply comes into being and goes out of being. So I'm really the only one being that there is. You can't say that there's anything in the creation that doesn't come into being and out of being. It's continually changing. Being is not changing. So therefore, just by that, everything is mithya, ananda, satyam. But there's only one satyam. And that is me. There's only one. And so this very personal me is you. Not like you, it is you, it is Ishwara, it is Tibi, it is all living beings. So with this verse, he's talking about what it really means, what it is like for somebody who has knowledge, and then he says that person who no longer has any sankalpas means I don't need this to be happy or that to be happy. This is all really just myself, and nothing can change me in any way. Nothing can improve me or take away from me or give me a different experience. There's many different experiences, but the self experience is changeless. So when that is understood, then a person goes, this is the little bit I didn't touch on last week, this last quarter of the second verse, second line. then a person goes to what's called amanastham. Amanastham means, for that person, there is a state of there being no mind. And what they mean by no mind is not that a mind is not there. Because as long as you have a body, and as long as you're this body is there, there is a mind there. But the mind is not bound by ignorance. And so it's no longer the ahankara, for that mind is not there. And so the ahankara as satyam, that I notion as satyam, that isn't there. And so there's no false identification. And so what that means then is every experience that I have, right? I'll make a little detour in a moment here, but this is something beautiful. In when we think, often, this has come over to us from yoga, from Patanjali Yoga, when we think of nirvikalpa samadhi, or being, getting to be with myself, yeah, just to be me, right? We often will think, depending on what we've experienced before coming to Vedanta, we think that I have to be with myself, I have to withdraw my mind. I have to withdraw my mind, and we'll get into this in the next verse, so that I have like a nirvikalpa samadhi where there is no mind. Amanastam means, I can take it, it means there is no mind at all there. There's only non-dual Brahman. Right? Only non-dual Brahman. And so that means there's no world, there's no jiva, there's no mind, there's no sense organs, there's experience of nothing except conscious being. Okay? But that's not how we would look at it in Vedanta at all. Because with my mind open, my sense organs open, experiencing this world, there is nothing here but me. I have to understand that, or I don't understand mitya. It would be like the, if I use the big rectangular block of clay with a bas-relief carving in it. For anybody who's looking at that bas-relief carving, they can see the beautiful intricate carving, and they can say, how beautiful this one piece of clay, such a beautiful intricate carving in this clay. Really, there's only clay. And that's, you experience that. You experience the clay along with the intricate carving. But the fact that there's only clay here is obvious. There's no confusion, right? And so if, say, somebody says, oh, what a beautiful, isn't that beautiful? A block of clay that could be carved so intricately. You say, oh, that's wonderful, amazing. So can we say like that, isn't this a beautiful consciousness? This is just an infinite expression of consciousness. There's really nothing here at all except conscious being. That's the reality, and that is there to be seen. But for that to be seen, the reality of it to be appreciated, that viveka is necessary, that discrimination is necessary. And it's going to, kind of looks like this, if I were to try to put words to this recognition, is that you have to, just looking out through your sense organs now, there's something you have to kind of become conscious of, two things. You need to be conscious of your own presence, which is self-evident, just the conscious being that you are, this me. Okay? The being itself, the conscious being, the consciousness, the being, that is you. That's the subject, that's the self of the subject. Okay? It's conscious being. And then there is everything else. Whatever perceptions are there, whatever thoughts may be flowing through the mind, we can say the vritti. Any given vritti at any moment, say. There's you, you are present, and the vritti, the thought modification, whether it's being born of sense perception, or it's being born of a memory, or the focus is more on an emotional situation, still, what is present is you and the vritti. Everybody see what I mean? The vritti is something, say we take the vritti as something that's being given, is being generated by sense perception. It's still a vritti, it's still a thought modification. So now, I can, if I'm just quiet for a moment, I can recognize in this thought modification that is a perception of this room, there is the subject, I can divide it into the subject and object, where me, Brahman, the self, is the subject, changeless subject, and everything else in the experience, right, is what is being objectified, but in no way distant or away from conscious being. Because if it was away from this conscious being, which is me, I wouldn't be conscious of it, and it wouldn't have being. Because something that comes into being and goes out of being doesn't have being of its own. And so now in my mind, I have to differentiate my own being, this being, which is kind of the warp and woof, the very self of my experience, from all of this stuff that is coming and going. All of this stuff that is coming and going is coming and going in a stable me. This has to be recognized. Once you recognize, it's actually never not there. But when I recognize that, and my mind, having recognized that my own presence is the as the source of the fullness that I seek, my mind isn't being a mind. It's not running out, I want this and I need that. That ahamkara activity of the mind is not there. And so once this is seen, my mind is just relaxing, really as amanastam. It's quiet. It's enjoying the presence. It's enjoying Ishwara. That's what I would say. It's enjoying thy own being and this manifestation that is being experienced. And it's that way because I'm not asking it to be different. I'm not saying, I don't have a prayer to Ishwara that says, please let me have it this way, or please come and bless me and take away this situation and make this situation so that I, because I'm a devotee, so that I can be happy, you know, or please save me from this difficulty, or please bless this situation so that I can have this. Or even as a mumukshu, please give me a situation where I can really gain this knowledge and give me the antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind, so that I can understand this knowledge. That's manastum. My mind is still operating. It's still needing this and wanting this and wanting that. What about when the mind is not asking for anything other than what is here? I'm present to what is here, and I'm responding to what is here. That, in fact, is the reality. That's the reality. Everything else is imagination. It's either worry over the past or imagination and projection into the future. And you always have to bring your mind back to get anything done. I'm not even talking about knowledge now. To get anything done, you have to bring your mind back to here, to what you need to do right here, right now. Your mind spins off, worrying about this, worrying about that, living in the emotional soup of whatever I'm projecting, or I'm distressed by all the things that happened in the past, so now I'm out here. What do you need to do just to be a competent person in the world? You have to bring yourself back to the present and do what needs to be done. If that mind is not doing, living the life of raga dvesha, I need this to be happy and I need not to have this to be happy. If it's not living that life of raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, then it can be present. That's the amanastam. It goes to that amanastam. It goes to that state of just being with what is and doing what needs to be done in the moment. That's really the simple mind of a jnani. What else I want to say about that? That's good enough for that. That's what I wanted to talk about. Because now he's going to go into how does that knowledge take place? How does knowledge itself take place? So he says, akalpakam ajam jnanam, the knowledge that needs to be gained by the mind is itself, that knowledge is itself akalpakam. Akalpakam means it's non-dual. It's not sankalpa vikalpa. It's not an imagination. It's not a perception. It's not a cognition. Like, for instance, say, if I use my sense organs to see this room, that's a cognition. It's like a painting, right? It's a cognition of something. Or say I have a memory, that's a painting. It's a cognition of something. This jnanam is not a cognition of something. It's a cognition whose content is its own self. Right? So the content of the mind for self-knowledge is not going to be a cognition of something else. It's going to be a resolution into the very subject of the mind, to the very conscious being of the mind. So think of that's not the normal situation. Whenever you're gaining knowledge of something, a cognition of that something needs to take place. And then the awareness, the conscious being, which is the self of the mind, is the knownness or the knowership, which that the knownness which that cognition enjoys. So say I have a thought right now, say I have a thought of this room. I now have a cognition which is known. The cognition is different than the knownness. The cognition is the duality. Whatever I'm perceiving is the duality. Or I have a memory. That cognition is known. Whatever thought I have, that cognition is known. And so through my sense organs, I'm having one cognition after another based upon the different pramanas that I'm using. And each one is known. Well, what happens when I'm now not gaining a cognition through a means of knowledge that is going to give me a subject-object relationship? Right? What about when the knowledge that I'm seeking is the knowledge of the very self which allows a cognition to be known? You see the problem? So now the knownness that illumines all cognitions is the object that needs to be known. And that subject, that ultimate subject, which is the knownness of the cognition, can't itself become an object of a cognition. Because what's going to divide the subject, the awareness that's illumining the cognition from the awareness that's illumining the cognition? There's no way for there to be a subject-object relationship there. So what he says is that knowledge, that jnanam, is itself ajam. Itself is unborn, means it's changeless. Because it's the subject, the ultimate subject, is not objectifiable to exist as an object in time. So it's changeless. And it has no content other than itself. So it's like saying the knownness now, the knownness which cannot be objectified but which illumines every vritti that comes along, that knownness now is the subject of the cognition. And so what you have then, you have knownness, consciousness itself, which is not subject to any type of modification because it's not objectifiable, and it has no content other than knownness, consciousness. And that knowledge is jnaya abhinnam. That knowledge is not different. It's abhinna. It's not different from the thing which is to be known. So if I want to know myself, I want self-knowledge, then the knowledge has got to be non-different from the self that is to be known. Where is the duality going to be? Here, there's duality. I am not what I see. There's a subject-object relationship. Right? But what about when I want to know the subject? Then the subject is the subject of the knowledge. Right? And so the knowledge has got to be true to the subject. And so the knowledge here cannot be different from the subject, or it would be something that exists also in duality. And so the subject, that the conscious being that you are, is the conscious being that needs to be known. Okay? How to know it? How to know the conscious being which needs to be known? What is the means of knowledge for it? That's what he's getting. How does that take place? And so he's going to do some other verses on this, but let me just go through this and we'll talk about the different type of the way this knowledge takes place. First of all, he says that the knowledge itself is ajam. It's free from birth. It has no imaginal content. It means there's no duality in the vritti. There can't be. If there's duality in the vritti or difference in the vritti, then it's within duality. So the content of that vritti has to itself be free from any duality. It has to be unborn, because if it's born, the content of the knowledge exists within time. And Brahman doesn't exist within time. It's the very being of time, but it doesn't exist as an object within time. And so this knowledge has to itself be identical with that which is to be known. What is to be known is the self. So the knowledge and the self have to be one and the same. Prachakshate means so the Brahmavids, those who know Brahman, are the ones who are explaining this. Then he says, what is to be known is Brahman, Brahmajnayam. So the infinite nature of this Atma is what is to be known. Yourself as a conscious being is already known. You just have superimposed on this body, mind, sense organs. But what is to be known is that this self that I am is Brahman, is infinite, is changeless. And this self, which is Brahman, is itself ajam, unborn. It is nityam, it is free from time. And if it weren't unborn and nityam and free from time, and Brahman means that which is infinite, right? But if it were infinite within the world, then it would be infinitely dual. So there wouldn't be anything to find there. This is Brahman as the infinite subject, right? Which has to be nityam. It has to be free from time or it exists within duality. So he's saying, this jnanam is the same as what is to be known, which is Brahman. And this ajam, this unborn Brahman, vibhujyate, is to be known by that which is itself unborn. Okay, so you have to make sense out of this. Okay, let me explain it. Different ways to go about this, but from the standpoint of you, the Atma, the conscious being, because you are Satyam. And everything else is mithya. This is really the whole Vedanta. Because you are Satyam and everything else is mithya, there is nothing here that isn't you. And so from your standpoint, there's no problem at all. You have to remember, when you think Satyam, mithya, you have to think of the clay pot and the rope snake. You think of the clay pot from that drishtanta, you can see that from the standpoint of the clay, literally, the only thing there is clay. And if the pot is recognized, it's recognized as being me alone, because that's the truth of it. There is nothing there that is not me. And now if we use the example of the clay pot, which is the primary example for the Satyam Nitya, I have the same situation here. Except I'm not looking at the pot and the clay with my eyes, where both the pot and the clay are illumined. And then you can easily say, there's nothing there but clay, really. That's easy. But in this situation, I have to say, there's nothing here but me. And in this situation, the me is not objectifiable. The mithya is objectifiable through the sense organs. But consciousness is not objectifiable. So I have to be consciousness and recognize myself as consciousness and differentiate my being from all of these names and forms which themselves have nothing but me as their content. But I'm not one of the things to look at to differentiate this consciousness from these names and forms. It's not the same. It's not that consciousness is not the same order of reality as the names and forms, where I can objectify both. Say, oh, look at this, is really nothing but consciousness. You see this consciousness here? You can't say it like that. You have to say I am nothing but consciousness, and nothing that I experience is away from me. And then you try to find something that is away from me, and at the same time, well, what you have to say like this, in my experience, there is nothing separate from me, and there's nothing that touches me at the same time. It's like, if there's nothing but consciousness, then there's nothing that can touch consciousness, because there's nothing but consciousness. Right? If there's nothing but consciousness, then that's non-dual, and there's no second thing to encroach upon it or to cover it. And so I have to be able to say, all of this is me alone. Now, the problem is that the one who has to say that is the one who doesn't recognize that. Consciousness doesn't have a problem because consciousness isn't saying anything. Right? Consciousness doesn't have a mind in that sense. So in the standpoint of the mind has taken itself to be consciousness and it's living within the mitya. It itself is mitya living within the mitya. See, that's like the dream character living within the dream. And so the dream character is using all of his or her limited faculties, you know, which are really, in truth, nothing but consciousness, and using the limited faculties to experience perceptions that themselves are nothing but consciousness. So I have to be able to recognize that this body, mind, sense organs is nothing but consciousness, and the couch that I'm looking at also is nothing but consciousness. But the subject and the object are nothing but consciousness. The consciousness, though, is not an object. Like, say if I say, you know, here's a backjack, and here's a backjack, and here's a backjack, and here's a couch. These are all different from each other, right? This is different from this, is different from this, is different from this, and I am different from that. I can't put consciousness into this mix. And then I could say, but all these things are different from each other, and all of them are equally different from the consciousness, as though consciousness was a thing. Consciousness is not the thing. Consciousness is the subject of all things. Right? So consciousness is the non-objectifiable clay. If there's nothing but clay, right, and all things are only clay, then from the standpoint of the clay, there's no problem. There's only clay. That's it. But it's from the standpoint of the objects in the clay who think of themselves as clay, different from this clay, different from this clay. That's the problem. And so how to recognize myself? The problem is this. Consciousness is not a knower. Consciousness is simply conscious being. I am simply conscious being. Right now, from my own standpoint, and this is something to recognize. This isn't just some hypothetical. It's something to recognize about yourself, about your own presence. You're the me that you are. You're not doing anything. You're just whole and complete, and your presence is the self of the entirety of your experience. It's the whole and complete me, self, not doing anything, just conscious being, which is ever-present as the very center and moves out to the peripheral of every experience that you have. And you're not doing anything. Your eyes are seeing, your ears are hearing, your mind is thinking, all these activities are going on, but this me, you, aren't doing anything at all. That's noticeable for you. You just have to notice it. Another thing that you can notice just right here and now is that you also aren't located anywhere. Your body is located here. Your thoughts are located here, wherever you want to put them, within subtle space. You know, your sense organs are located here. These have location. But what about me, conscious being? Where are you located? Just experientially, I mean, where are you located? Say in this room, where are you located in the room? Your body is located here. Sense organs are located here. But notice just your own presence. It's not located. Sometimes I say, just imagine that's just your own presence, not your body, not your mind, your sense organs, or anything like that. Just your own conscious being. Just put it in the middle of the room. You don't really have to do that, but I mean, just what I'm trying to let you do is just kind of recognize that actually this me is not something that's contained. It's not contained, and it's not spatial. Your own presence is not spatial. Why do I say that? It's like if I ask you to imagine a meadow, a beautiful meadow, with people walking through it and animals and trees and all that, the meadow imagination. The meadow imagination that has dimension, it has space, it has depth, right? So the duality and the spatial duality, the extension, spatial extension, exists in that imagination. If I withdraw the imagination, the spatial extension is withdrawn, right? I'm not withdrawn. So I have nothing to do with the spatial extension. You know what I mean by extension, like depth and width and height? So that comes along with the imagination. But now that imagination takes place in me as those, okay? So where am I in that imagination? Right? So it's not a fair question, right? Because it's not like that. But you can notice that right now, that your self is not contained at all. And it's not, has nothing to do, your being, this me that you are, has nothing to do with spatial extension. You're not big or tall or wide or anything like that. That all belongs to the imagination. The space, spatial extension, and depth, width, height, all of this belongs to the imagination or belongs to the creation. So now when you think of me, your own presence, you have to remove the whole concept of spatial extension. And then that creates something different. If you recognize something different to notice about the me, your own presence, right? Which is not an object within space. And so it's not big or small. These words simply don't apply. You are not big or small. You're not like vast. Vastness involves space. It doesn't apply to you. And now think like this. At the same time, everything comes from you. Just think about it in terms of the imagination. All spatial extension depends upon your being. But your being cannot be defined by big or small. Sometimes it's been called an infinite point. Your being, I kind of like that actually. It can be a little confusing, but your being is like an infinite point that's non-dual. Once you say infinite, it means, why they say point is because there's no space in a point. Yeah, but if it's infinite, it means it's non-dual. You are non-dual. So what that means is your being is totally free, but it's the very, very center, the very self, the non-dual, infinite point self of the spatial extension that you're experiencing right now through your sense organs. So now you have to differentiate this me from this projection of the creation, this Ishvara. And then you notice Ishvara's self also has no spatial extension. It's just non-dual. That's why every thought that you have cannot be away from that, because that non-dual self is satyam. It means it's not an object within duality to come into being and go out of being. So it actually is what is. Infinite point is a problem also, because then you think, well, it must be just a little tiny little point. That's also a problem. You have to understand it, you have to focus in on just your own presence that cannot be touched in any way by any thought you have, by any emotion you have, by any experience you have, by the universe itself. Nothing can touch me or cover me in any way. That's another problem we have. We think, I need this antikarana shuddhi, I need this really pure mind so that my mind can see myself. But actually, you are illumining the mind. You are the self of the mind. Because of you, the mind, with all its impurities and all of its problems and all of that, because of you, this mind is known. You're not covered. The self is never, ever covered. We need this antikarana shuddhi, purity of mind and all of this, so that the mind has the shanti, the peace, to be able to differentiate itself from me. It needs to have some sort of quietude, some sort of space, to be able to listen to this teaching taking place and have the mind kind of see what's being said. That requires a mind that's really totally present, that's not lost in its ragged dveshas or lost in its pains and hurts and unconscious complexes and all of the things that distract us. That's what the antikarana shuddhi is about. But really, in the end, for the jnani, shuddhi, antikarana shuddhi, is all irrelevant. It all resolves itself into the wholeness of my own being once I have enough antikarana shuddhi to gain that knowledge. That's the tricky part. I need a certain amount of antikarana shuddhi, dharma, maturity, to be able to see this. Because otherwise, my mind's too engaged in itself, in its own problems and its likes and dislikes. But when the mind is available, then what happens is the very self, which is the non-dual content truth of the mind, right, is recognized by that mind, by a vritti that has for its content only the self that illumines it. Right? Normally, consciousness provides the knownness to every vritti I have. But the vritti is something that's born of pramanas giving me thought modifications within duality. Through when this teaching works as a pramana, it's taking your mind step by step by step to really resolving into the mind's own self. This is the important part. The mind's own self is Brahman. It's like the clay, the pot resolving into the clay. Well, the pot already is resolved into the clay. So here, the mind, but it as though resolves into what it already is. In the clay pot, the pot resolves into what actually it already is. Because the pot is mitya. Your mind is mitya. It really is nothing but awareness. That's itself. But now the thing is, the mind is so used to being mitya upon mitya, you know, mitya sense organs, mitya vritti, mitya sense organs, mitya sense objects. Now, all these mitya means the sense objects are the self, the pramanas, the means of knowledge are the self, the mind is the self is the self that illumines it. There's really only the self there. But this mitya mind doesn't know that. Because of ignorance, it takes itself to be the self, which it is, but it doesn't realize that it is mitya and the self, which it is satyam. It doesn't realize this different order of reality. And so now the mind has to be kind of collapse on itself to recognize itself. The mind has to recognize itself as mitya and differentiating itself from its own truth. The mind has to differentiate itself from its own being. It's not about being another being. It's differentiating the mitya mind from itself. Right? It's like differentiating the pot, having to differentiate itself from the clay, which it is. So you have to differentiate your mind from Brahman, the Brahman which you are. To do it, there's things have to be understood here, like the different order of reality, the fact that Brahman is, Brahman consciousness is not an object. If it's an object within creation, it's mitya. It has no being. And so that non-dimensionality, non-dual nature of your being has to be recognized. But even in contemplation, if you ask, just kind of absorbing it just to your own being, if you ask yourself, you know, how big am I? What color am I? How much do I weigh? These are totally irrelevant questions. There are no answers to these questions. They're totally irrelevant questions, inapplicable questions. I'm not a color. I don't weigh anything. I'm not tall or short. These words don't, these questions don't apply. Then what size are you? I'm not a size. What are you then? I'm just me. I'm Brahman. I'm no Brahman. That's what has to be recognized, but it's a differentiation. It's a viveka that has to take place. And so it's really the unborn changeless self is recognized by the unborn changeless self. That's what it is. But this takes place as a vritti in the mind. But then we think that the mind is something. The mind itself is only consciousness. But it's mithya. Like the, it's only consciousness. It's only the self. But it's also the mind.
Mm.
Like that. The clay pot is so powerful to understand that the pot is only clay, but there's a pot there. The mind is only consciousness, but there's a mind there. And so the conscious being, which is the mind, needs to recognize the conscious being itself, which is free of the mind. The conscious being, which is the mind, needs to recognize itself, the conscious being, which is free of the mind. We have both things happening right now at all times. You, the conscious being, that is never objectifiable and never changes in any way and is the very subject, non-dual subject of every experience you have, right? And all of the experiences which have that as their self, equally changelessly. And so in a way, you would think that this is easy to recognize because there's an invariable.
Hmm.
One invariable. Everything else is variable. But the mind has to want to recognize it. That's why the mumukshutvam is so important. Because the mind isn't necessary. Mind can want to recognize it. That'd be nice to recognize. But I have this to do and that to do and this to do and that to do. And I'm worried about this and I'm worried about that. And what's going to happen to me here and what's going to happen to me there. And so even though it wants to recognize this, there's a lot of raga dveshas that are habitually there, that overwhelm. And that's why all this karma yoga and all of these things that we do, just to give the mind a space to settle down. Because the mumukshutvam is there, but the mind has a lot of needs and a lot of what I call emotional lag time, habitual thinking. And so we have to provide tools for that, to help that habitual thinking until the knowledge itself, the understanding itself on the part of the mind is so much stronger than the habitual thinking that it all just drops off. And your mind itself is an expression of knowledge. That's not how it starts out. It starts out, they use the example of a bonfire. Somebody builds on the beach a great big, huge bonfire, and then they have to light it. And so they have to find a little corner, this big bonfire to light, and they light it and they protect it and fan it and protect it from too much wind and all of this and take care of it and get it going. But once it starts going, gets to a certain size, then it's gone. It's just going to keep going until the whole bonfire has been consumed. But until that time, there needs to be some protection, you know, until it takes off. So that's our situation. This is an example, I think it's used in the Bhagavad Gita, actually. There's this knowledge is initially competing with a lot of ajnanam. It's like this little candle coming into this dark room. That it has to light up, so that flame has to be protected until it burns through all the ajnanam and everything is lit up. That's what he's going to say, something nice like that later. I'm going to stop there. Yeah. swasti prajata paripaliyantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go pramane bhyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sikino pavantu kale varshati parjanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yam shobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Arihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Well, hearing this unfoldment, words kept coming to my mind, and I'm wondering if it's almost the same unfoldment or if there's a difference. And that vritti vyapti and palavyapti.
Yeah, good. I decided not to undo do that. I'll do it later in another couple of verses, but exactly.
It is, okay.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. I will go do, when I do that, I'll do it a little bit more technically than I did today. Today I put more emphasis on something that, it's kind of amazing what Gaudapada does in his teaching style, is he talks about, there's the whole unfoldment from you, from the standpoint of the Atma, like it is your mind. This mind is the Atma's mind. It's the mind of the self. It's just that the mind is mitya, you know, and you are satyam. And so often when we're teaching from the standpoint of Ishvara, from the standpoint of the jiva, recognizing the self. But he's saying, there is nothing here but me. I am the conscious being, and this is my mind. It's nobody else's mind. He's not talking about the jiva, though. He's talking about me, the conscious self. And so the whole unfoldment is taking place from that perspective, you know, which is it's beautiful, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's also why the Mandukya is the last text that's taught before the Brahma Sutras.
It seems to me that Brahman illumines this mind, but the mind will always say that I am the consciousness, even though your knowledge is that it's being illumined. It seems like that notion will be present to the mind. It's
well,
very nature.
That's the whole thing. That's
mm-hmm.
the problem.
No, I didn't mean it as a problem. Even if you overcome that problem, it's the mind will still be saying that I am the luminary. Even though it's being illumined. Even though you know that.
Well, I don't quite know what you mean. Like if I say, if I'm speaking from a standpoint of knowledge, and I say, I, the Atma, and I, the mind is talking,
yeah,
but it's saying that I, meaning I, the Atma, am the luminary.
Yeah.
That's true, because only the mind can talk. The mind and vocal cords can talk. But I can talk about myself as the Atma
yeah.
in terms of knowledge, my own self-knowledge. Or I can talk as an Ajnani about I, the mind, am the Atma. But Gaudapada talks about me, the self, the non-dual self, which is Brahman. This is my mind. And it is my mind because it's nobody else's mind. Right? It's just that this mind that is me is mitya.
Yeah, that mitya mind, though, mitya mind will continually say that that notion will still be there, even though even though it's been informed?
That notion won't be there. That's not true.
So it vanishes? Is what you, it really evaporates then?
The mind doesn't evaporate.
No, the mind doesn't, but the idea, the thinking that it's the source of consciousness...
That evaporates.
Totally.
Well, I mean, we might not be saying the same thing.
I don't know if this is on the same point or not, but it sounded like the process you were describing that the mind goes through is at some point it's no longer looking at itself, but at the self that it really is. It's no longer looking at the mind, but it's almost as though gazing on the self. That's the education that the mind goes through from thinking what I think Edward is saying to actually recognizing that its self is the self, not itself is Brahman, not
the mind.
Not the mind.
Yeah, that becomes the fact for the mind. The mityatva of the mind is recognized by the mind. And that the conscious being that is itself is recognized as Brahman.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like there will still be that burnt seed kind of idea that the mind has that it is the self, even though it's been educated to see that it isn't.
No, there's one thing you're missing there that I think what might make it clear. The mind is the self, just like the pot is the clay. Right, the pot is the clay, right? There's nothing else there. So the self that the mind has always taken itself to be, it realizes, yes, that is myself, but the self is satyam, where I am mitya. Right? So it recognizes that its own self, which has always been itself, is Brahman. That's the difference. It's not that it doesn't think that that's itself, that always will be itself, always has been itself, but that self is the self of everything. That's why it's so also important to think, to understand this non-dimensional nature of me, of conscious being, because this conscious being that, it's not that I become, expand out to become the self of everything. Just like you don't expand out to become the self of your imagination, you are the self of your imagination because there's no other self there. It doesn't have anything to do with expanding or changing. Or I don't have to expand out to be, for my being to be Ishvara, for my being to be infinite. No, because when we say infinite, we mean non-dual. For my being to be infinite, Brahman, an infinite self means the self in all beings, I don't have to change size. I have no size. Size belongs to duality. Size is relative, a relative term. Big or small, that's relative. That's spatial. I'm not spatial, I'm non-dual. It would be like this, say they use this in the Chandogya, you roll up the universe like a piece of leather and toss it aside. What happens to you, to your being? Nothing. You don't become bigger or smaller. There's no change at all. There's just non-dual you. There is nothing else. You know, it's not even that you're infinitely big or infinitely small. It's nothing like that. It's non-dual. The size doesn't come into play when something's non-dual. There is nothing else.
I like the illustration where you're asking, you know, what size am I? How tall am I? What color am I? And kind of coming back to our discussion from Thursday, you know, in the same vein, it's like, you know, where do I reincarnate? You know, I don't reincarnate.
Not at all. There's no birth or death. That's right. What I mean by ajam.
Yeah.
The me that is here right now is timeless.
So why do we talk about reincarnation? What's reincarnation?
Subtle body. Just like this physical body is born and dies, the subtle body is what reincarnates according to karma and takes birth after birth after birth. As taught in the Vedas.
Yeah.
That's not something that that we know through our own means of knowledge, even though there are anecdotal, there's some anecdotal evidence, if you want. Anecdotal doesn't really mean evidence, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that there's reincarnation seems to exist. But that's what it is. That's what is just anecdotal evidence.
Yeah, and it's also mithya that's
reincarnating. Mithya, absolutely.
It's not me.
No.
Oh, so Vedanta doesn't talk about it then? Is that what you're saying?
No, Vedanta talks about all of it, but to talk, Vedanta's thorough. The one who has to gain self-knowledge is this body-mind reincarnating jiva. This is the one who's suffering from ignorance, not the self. Mm. Ishwara is mithya. Ajnanam is mithya.
Right.
Yeah.
And to use the clay illustrations, like, well, okay, right now the form is a pot. Pot doesn't realize it's clay. Then it turns, you know, something happens, goes back into the vat, and it's made into a plate. Plate doesn't recognize it's clay. It's turned into, you know, goes back into the vat, and then it's turned into, you know, a swan.
Yeah.
And then the swan goes, I'm clay. Great, you figured it out. I mean, isn't that the equivalent of...
Well, in a sense, the thing...
reincarnating? It's just like it's just taking new forms, and then...
Well, say there's but we would do it a little bit different than that.
Okay.
The physical body is actually born and dies, right? The subtle body, they say, is made of subtle material, the sattva. It goes on transmigrating based upon karma.
Mm-hmm.
And so your experience as a jiva,
yeah.
When this body dies, the subtle body, which is indwelling this body, according to the karma, will go on to another life, another set of experiences. And ajnanam continues. Right, because the subtle body, part the mind is part of the subtle body, and that sense of I am a conscious being. Oh, now, but it'll be excited that oh, there really is no death, right? But it doesn't. That's not liberation. It still takes itself to be a subtle body, and according to the karmas, then it'll take another body. All the while, your being is not reincarnating. Your being is the very self of the entire creation. But there's self ignorance there on the part of the mind that. Doesn't know that.
So, this is raising Helmut's question from 8 days ago. So the subtle body that reincarnates.
Yeah.
There's something about it that is constant throughout the reincarnations, right?
Yes.
Because there has to be something. I think that's what his question was.
The question is twofold. There's two answers to that question.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the Atma doesn't reincarnate at all, because it's not objectifiable, it's not in time, it's the very being of the entire creation. So that me, there's no change at all. The subtle body is not subject to death, right? It goes on taking birth after birth after birth. The only thing that brings the subtle body to an end is the removal of its cause, which is ajnanam, ignorance. So the one thing about ignorance is it's beginningless, but it comes to an end. There's nothing else like that. Everything else comes into being, goes out of being, except for ignorance. Ignorance is beginningless, but it comes to an end. And so when that comes to an end, then it's the end of the subtle body, and you are just Ishwara as you always have been.
Is the subtle body a part of the mind that actually...
No, the mind
gains
is
knowledge?
Part of...
I mean, does the subtle body gain knowledge, or is it just affected by... the gain of knowledge that the mind...
Yeah, the mind is part of the subtle body. So the subtle body, let me just tell you the components that make up this transmigrating entity that we call the jiva. Really what makes it a jiva is the ajnana. That's what holds it together as a jiva. It's the five pranas, the five karmendriyas. The five pranas are, you know, the peristaltic movement, circulatory, digestive, ingoing and outgoing breath, the... evacuation. Those are the five pranas. And then the karmendriyas are the organs of action, which would be like your hands grasping, walking with your feet, vak, speech. Evacuation is a karmendriya. For prana, it's that downward motion. the actual act of evacuation and sexuality is the karma indriya, those five. Then the five sense organs. You know, so there's 15. And then the four types of vrittis in the mind. So that would be the buddhi, the intellect, the manas, fluctuating mind and emotions are there. And then the chitta, memory, and then the ahankara. So those are the 19 components together that transmigrate as the subtle, that
but
we call
all
the subtle
of that is
body.
Subtle, right?
No. Subtle body, yeah.
Okay. Then how can you be sure that you're not identifying with the subtle body then? I mean, sometimes you can, you know.
Well, the identification from the standpoint of the subtle body will be there, but the question is the satya-mithya relationship clear? The consciousness, conscious being, your being, is of a different order of reality from the physical universe, the physical body, and the subtle body. It's a different order of reality because it's not objectifiable and you never change. You're not variable. Even the subtle body with all of these components are continually changing all the time. The thoughts are always changing, the moods are always changing, the prana, you know, the way it's enlivening the body, all of that is fluctuating.
Change.
That's all mitya, but you are not mitya.
Yeah.
So of those 19 components, you said 19?
Yeah.
Of the subtle body, does one of those components include memory?
Yeah, chitta. That's right, there's the chitta, the memory, and you can probably put all of the sanchitta karmas in the chitta also.
So how come this subtle body doesn't have experience of prior memory?
I think because the subtle body now, once it takes this physical body, then it's going to be influenced by the physical brain. So there's, in a way, a clean slate, but they'll say it has some samskaras and vasanas tendencies. But those tendencies are going to be making grooves into a fresh brain. Which is why they say when these stories of reincarnation and all that, those usually happen to a child at a young age when they have a lot of these memories. They're not even supposed to have those memories, but there's a lot of instances where they do, and they're able to identify their prior lives and things like that. But it's kind of like a subtle body coming into this physical body, and somehow it's been able to leave some sort of impression on the brain, kind of like, I'm making this up in a way, but this is what I think it's like. You know, when you have a dream, you have like, this. I'm not making this part up, you have 10 seconds to catch that dream, to imprint it on your brain.
Or you, when you wake up?
Yeah, you've got 10 seconds. You really dream all night, they think, but you don't remember them, right? But to remember them, you have to catch it.
Yeah.
You have to imprint it. Okay. Yeah. And so when the subtle body comes into the physical body, what allows it to, it needs to imprint somehow those memories, or they're not going to be available. So they say there's some scars, like why does a child, for instance, find themselves to be like a prodigy of some sort, and that type of thing.
Tibetan.
Good, and some things come very easy, all that type of thing.
Tibetan
there's
Buddhism has a lot of that, too.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have actually pursued that much more.
Yeah.
But that's all in India also. Yeah.
So when it's the mind that removes, or the ajnana is removed from the mind, and that sort of unlocks the entire subtle body from the cycle of reincarnation?
Well, what they say, to be more specific, the self-ajnana is removed from the mind, which means that there's no longer a hankara there. And so there's a couple of very big things that change in terms of your own orientation. One is that the ahankara now lands on the self, so it's not an I notion anymore. And the self is stable. The other thing is, and changeless, the other thing is that the ananda, or the wholeness that you've been seeking in the world, is now found. Right? Because the very source of all of your experiences of ananda and fullness is really only the self. And so that illusion has been broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so now, when that's the case, and the mind has had a chance to get over the emotional lag time and all the habitual responding, the mind now is already really with yourself. That's where it's reveling.
Mm.
And so when the body dies, there's no ajnanam, which had been kind of functioning as the gasoline, now I want this, to keep that jiva kind of going. Now there is even, for ajnani, there's the remnants of a jiva here because the body, mind, sense organs are here. But in another sense, there is no jiva here because there's no ignorance. So you're living out the prarabdha karma, but your self-identity is with Brahman. It's with your being, right?
Would it be fair to say, and I'm just making this up, that the ahankara kind of grabs onto the self, onto Brahman, and therefore it's no longer drifting in this, like...
That's right. Ahankara means the I notion, the kara,
yeah,
is gone, right? It's no longer I notion. Now the I resolves into the hum, resolves into the self.
Mm-hmm.
And that's stable, and it's whole and complete. It's what you'd been trying to get in the world. What makes you a mumukshu is you realize, I can't get it here. I can't get that. What I know is me. What I need to be. I can't fulfill that here.
Mm.
That's what makes you a mumukshu, because if you can't fulfill it here, then what can you do?
Mm.
That's when you kind of pray to God, if there's a solution to this, please help me.
But then for the yoni, then this travel of the subtle body has been extinguished.
It doesn't go anywhere. And if it's going to go anywhere, it means you have some vasanas or some things you still need to experience. Then you will. Yeah.
Because you don't have anything more to do with it. Even the strong tendencies or strong urges, they've been cared for.
Well, you might have strong tendencies and urges as part of the prarabdha, but this idea that I have to do this so that I can be happy, that won't be there. Because it's not true. Yourself isn't
going...
You know that, and it's a reality. Yourself isn't going to become happier or sad. Yourself is what it is, and it's whole and complete. The problem we have is that there's unconscious material in the mind, there's complexes, there's hurts, there's, you know, likes and dislikes, and ways that I react to the world, in the world, things that upset me and agitate me and all of these type of things. You come with whatever amount of that you come with is, you know, what is going to be falling off. And it's... falling off, it'll fall off because in the light of your knowledge, it's really not in your best interest because it's painful and it's not worth it.
And even if you are successful in removing some pain, it still really won't give you what you really want. I mean,
well,
you'll get relief from pain, but for that moment.
The removing of the sources, external sources of pain is endless.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
one source will be replaced by another. So that way of operating in the world is something that you drop off. And you become more interested. You're not asking the world to be pleasing. If your objective, your ananda, isn't dependent upon this person being this way and this person being that way. Otherwise, there's so many different types of people, and some people are, you know, maybe not people that you would choose to be around. You know? But what if your happiness isn't dependent on them being here or not being here? That's what we want. We want freedom.
Yeah.
Otherwise, Otherwise, we have to control the world, which is not controllable. Bhagavan makes sure. He makes sure to irritate you. If you can be irritated, he will do it. It's like it's his job. For your maturation, let's see, what can I throw your way to irritate you?
Well, it does seem like the more mature one gets, the more intense the challenges get bigger, for the most part.
I used to think that. I don't know if that's true or not, really. I think maybe what it, I'm not sure. I kind of think that the Bhagavan gives you always is right at your edge. You know, so they don't really get bigger. All along, they're right at your edge of what you can take. You know what I mean? So in a way, that idea of them being bigger.
Well, I guess if you're growing, then it's just getting bigger. But if you're not, then maybe it's getting smaller. Which can happen. I mean, you know.
I think it's hard, yeah. Yeah, assimilation of experience.
I have another question for me. So, what Gaudapada today, especially, it seems clear. It seems like he's really focusing more on recognizing Brahman than on the Satya-Mitya relationship. And that it also seems to me that it's easier for myself and maybe most people that's like a first step. Like we would, I know the Swamiji might be changing this, but, you know, Drik Drisha is kind of easier to get in a more starting place, whereas the Satya-Mitya is. And then realizing Ishwara is more after you kind of recognize who you are.
Yeah. I think Drik Drisha is really, really important. What we call a prakriya, teaching methodology, because it just separates everything. But the problem with it is everything becomes separate. Mm-hmm. And so whether if you do the Drik Drisha, then you have to deal with that you've now made everything separate. And you have to bring it all back. But if you just do the Satya Mitya, you haven't made everything separate. You know? And so then you have to make everything separate. So these two play off of each other. You know, Swamiji used to always, and since I was with him from the very beginning, in a sense, he used to always do Drik Drisha and then Satya Mitya. And that's how I kind of gained this knowledge, and I went through it that way. Mm-hmm. Now he starts more with Satya Mitya. Mm-hmm. And since I've listened to him enough now, doing it that way, I've started doing it that way myself, and there's good things about it that I really like. Mm-hmm. But then you have to be careful, because if you're doing that, you may not have differentiated the self enough from the mitya. You know, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
You need both of them. In the end, I've had conversations with Swamiji about this very thing. And so he finally said, well, in the end, you need both of them. Both of them, you know, they juxtapose them. They're both necessary to help you see completely. I think that's what I think is true. That's why they have all of these different prakriyas, you know, because each one has its power and its limitation. And so you do one, and then you bring in another one. And that's, oh, that's what it is. It never negates the other one, but it makes you see what the other one didn't make you see as well. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there's no right way of going about it.
No, not really. You can even start from the standpoint of Ishwara, but that's a little bit more difficult. It's probably but you can do that. But the easiest way is to start with your own experience as an individual, because within this body, mind, sense organs, there's both you, the Atma, and the subtle body and the mind, it's a whole thing to be analyzed. Whereas if I'm looking outside at, say, Ishvara, it's hard for me initially to recognize my consciousness as the consciousness of Ishvara, because I'm looking out at this universe. So it's easier to go through the body mind as a pathway, through the body mind sense organs to the Atma, than to recognize that this body mind sense organs belongs to Ishvara, because it's been objectified. And then this self then has no limits, so the self that I am must be the self that you are, must be the self that Ishvara is. Then you go back out to Ishvara to see what is the reality of this world that has conscious being for itself.
Going from this perspective, from the perspective of Gaudapada, is coming from what is to stop you having a solipsistic conclusion? I mean, in a sense, it is solipsistic.
Well, I think I would say one thing is this is a... If you look at... I don't think it's really solipsistic when I think about what he's doing, but to answer it how I would really feel comfortable answering it, is that the Mandukya itself is not solipsistic. And this Karika is on the Mandukya. So it's an unfoldment of the Mandukya Upanishad. The Mandukya Upanishad is talking about Virat and Hiranyagarbha and the Jiva Vishwa in Virat and Tajasa in Hiranyagarbha. It's not solipsistic at all. And so his unfoldment of the Mandukya, I don't see it as solipsistic.
But we're not doing that part right now in these verses, it seems.
Well, we're right now looking at, really, as everything is the Atma, which is Brahman. He's also used Atma and Brahman, just in this verse. If you use Atma and Brahman, it's not solipsistic, if you know what the meaning of the words mean.
Can you distinguish the two?
Yeah, Atma means the individual self. This individual self, the whole teaching of the Vedanta is that this Atma, the individual self, and this, the conscious being in this body, mind, sense organs, is Brahman. Brahman means the self of Ishvara, the self which is infinite. Okay? So how can this self be infinite? The body's not infinite. The mind's not infinite. The sense organs aren't infinite. How can I be infinite? How can I be Brahman? Right? If I'm Brahman, then I am the one self of all beings. That can't be solipsistic, because the mind is limited, the body is limited.
I don't understand why there being two different terms if it's the same thing.
Well, it's because you don't take yourself
to be Brahman.
So it's a teaching. There's a lot of logic involved and a lot of prakriyas and unfoldment to make you realize that this self that you take to be this body, mind, sense organs is the one non-dual self that we call Brahman. So to say Atma is Brahman is to like say you a wave, you are the ocean, you know. Or you a wave, the water that you are is the water of the whole creation. That takes a lot of teaching. They're not synonyms.
So it's like a jiva without ignorance?
No. It's the recognition that the conscious being that you are right now is the self of the whole creation. So how to recognize that? There's a lot of teaching involved in that. That self of the whole creation of Ishvara is what we call Brahman. So it's not just a synonym, where this individual self is this individual self. That would be a synonym. So the word Atma means the individual conscious being that is related to, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, myself. You know, me. And Brahman is the infinite self of Ishvara. So how can I say that me, this conscious being, is Brahman the self of Ishvara, the infinite self of Ishvara? So that's the whole teaching. The Mahavakya is that. What if I said the one Mahavakya is the Jiva tetvamasi, that thou art. That thou art, you can take it in two ways. You, the jiva, are Ishvara. How can I be Ishvara? Only from the standpoint of the self, or you can say, you, the conscious Atma that you are, is the infinite Brahman. Yeah. So there's something that has to be known, unknown there, that has to be made known. You see what I mean?
No.
Are you done?
But I'm okay with it right now.
Okay. But what don't you see? I'm just curious.
I'm having trouble just understanding why. I think we're saying that Atma is not different from Brahman.
Atma is Brahman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if that's true, then why does there need to be two different terms?
Well, because you come to me, say you come to your teacher.
Yeah.
And you say, I want to know who I am.
And then you're going to say you are Atma.
No.
I am Atma.
No, I'm not. Okay. I'm not going to say that.
Sorry.
Because you're going to come to me saying, I want to know who I, this Atma, is. I want to know who I am. Who is the self?
You my come, Atma asking that? Is that what you're
saying? You, the mind. You come to your teacher,
yeah,
as a conscious being, yeah, and you say, I'm a conscious being, but I don't know who I am.
Okay.
Okay? So I have a self, this Atma.
Yeah.
Myself, I called the Atma.
Yeah.
But I don't know who I am. I don't know who this Atma is.
Okay, maybe my question is, what's the difference between Atma and Jiva then?
The Jiva is the self that is ignorant, with the ignorant mind.
So it's true then that the Atma is the Jiva without ignorance.
The Atma is the Jiva. Okay, now it's getting confusing. The Atma, conscious being in reality, is just consciousness. It's never,
yeah,
ignorant.
Yeah.
But from the standpoint of the mind, right, that mind takes the Atma to belong to it. So the Atma is taken to be the mind. So say the seeker comes to the guru and says, I don't know who I am. Do I survive after death? Am I just my mind and subtle body that travels? Who exactly am I? And so there's no viveka between the body, the mind, the sense organs. Do I die when the body dies? Do I travel? Who am I? Do I survive death? Who am I? So that's the question that the teacher, that the student brings to the teacher. And so now your nature, who you actually are, needs to be unfolded, because you know who you are in terms experientially. I'm a conscious being, but I don't know if I survived death, or I don't know if I transmigrate, or what happens. Who am I really? And then the teacher has to unfold that, well, the self that you are is actually the self of the whole universe. And that you didn't know. You know that you're a conscious being, but you don't know you're the self of the whole universe. That's a pretty big jump.
That all I feel like I understand better than just the difference between the terminology.
That's just semantics,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, I think,
yeah,
it's
that's
semantics.
Vocabulary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's, I was just asking about that.
Yeah.
Little, semantics are a little confusing to me right now. But,
yeah.
But the crux of it is clear.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I understand. Yeah, it makes sense. You're welcome. Are we done?
Yeah.
Belinda, I'll explain this. That's a biggie, but I'll explain really quickly, okay? Brahman is the conscious, the self of Ishvara, and Atma is the self of the Jiva. So the Jiva has a conscious being of self, and Ishvara, the Lord, has a conscious being called Brahman.
Right, you said that.
And so the whole teaching is that the Atma, the self of the individual, is the self of Ishwara that we call Brahman. So the Atma is Brahman. Don't worry if you don't understand. This is a big class.
Didn't you say just now, and also the other day when Igor asked the question, the Atma is the self, not of the Jiva, but of the body-mind-sense organs. And the Jiva actually confuses what the self is.
Sometimes the Jiva is the one who still has ignorance. So the Jiva is the individual floating around in Ishwara. So the Jiva has to recognize that that myself is the self. So the Jiva has to get knowledge. It has to recognize that myself...
Jiva's imaginary, right? It's a product of ignorance. It's not real.
It's not real in the sense that...
It's mitya.
It's mitya. There are no two selves. But the mind mistakes itself to be the self, whereas actually the mind self is the self of Ishwara. Right? And so that mistake, when I say there is really no jiva, what I mean there is that there's no little atma that we call the jiva and a big atma that we call the atma. There's no two atmas. There's only one atma, and that atma, in fact, is Brahman.
Okay, so the jiva and the body-mind-sense organs are not the same.
They're not really the same. And sometimes we refer to it as that, like the jiva-brahma-aikyam. No, we sometimes can call it the jiva as the transmigrating individual and Ishwara as the Lord. But when we break down what is the jiva really, the jiva is a product of ignorance that causes that mind to take itself, which is Atma, the Atma, to belong to the body-mind-sense organs. That's the ajnanam that creates the ahankara, which is the jiva.
So you wouldn't say then that the Atma is the self of the jiva, because the jiva has no self. It's non-existent.
No, if you say that the Atma...
The body-mind-sense organs
If you say that the... I understand the confusion, but if you say the Atma is the self of the jiva, you're talking about this ignorant body-mind-sense organs that's taking... Or that has a self, but takes that self, that Atma, to belong to it.
So the self of the jiva is as
is
illusory as the jiva itself.
No, the self of the jiva is Brahman. I can't do this now. I understand.
Okay.
There's a
Let's come back to it.
You're very, very. What have we called you before?
Literal.
Very literal.
I'm being very specific.
I have to work on it with you.
I thought you said the other day, talking to Igor, because he asked a very similar question.
Yeah. Okay.
And it seemed like the answer was different than, and that you emphatically said that the Atma is not the self of the jiva. That was what I thought.
So I said what?
The Atma. He asked you a question. He asked you several times. He said, so the Atma is the self of the jiva and Brahman is the self of Ishwara. You said, no, Brahman is the self of Ishwara, but the Atma is not the self of the jiva.
No, I didn't say that. Or if I said that, was a total misuse of words. Because if the Atma is not the self of the jiva, then does the jiva have another self?
I thought it didn't have a self because it's fiction. It's a product of ajnana.
No, because we say you're a jiva. What makes you a jiva really is that there's an identify. You have a conscious being. You are a conscious being with the body, mind, sense organs. Right?
Well,
but
it's
this
more
conscious,
than just that, because even a jnani has that, right?
That's right. That's right.
But you wouldn't say a jnani is a jiva.
Well, okay, I can't do this now because there's some missing pieces here. I'm sorry, and
okay.
I can't unwrap it now. It's too much for me, and I'm too tired.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, you and I always get in this at the last minute, and then I can't continue on because to make it clear now is too much of a job. But it's wrong how you're thinking. It's not right. I have to make it clear,
okay.
Which I don't mind doing, but I can't do it now.
Okay.